Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today my guest is a co-author of an important book that documents the struggles of the working class achieving the American dream and the sometimes fatal consequences that result. It's a topic we're all too familiar with here in the heartland in our region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. The book is called Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. My guest today is the co-author, Angus Deaton, who wrote the book along with Ann Case. Angus is the winner of the 2015 Nobel Prize in Economics and Dwight D. Eisenhower Professor of Economics and International Affairs Emeritus at Princeton University and Presidential Professor of Economics at the University of Southern California. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Robin.
This is serious and somewhat depressing stuff, but I think it's important to talk about because we see it all around us. But what really got you, started looking at this topic, and when did this all kind of start taking place, and what were the forces behind it?
Yeah, well, we could talk about us first, and then talk a little bit about when we discovered it and how the phenomenon actually started, which was, of course, a bit before that.
Yeah.
But I think this was in the summer of 2013. And as always with things that are important and interesting, or often, I guess, we were really looking for something else. So I was working on suicide. Anne, sort of across the room in our cabin in Montana, over there we were staying in a cabin in Montana, was working on pain. And, we both established there was a big increase in both pain and in suicide in midlife, white, non-Hispanic Americans. And it was then that at some point during this, we thought, oh, it'd be good to put this in context. How big is this rise in suicide compared with other things that are going on? Maybe it's just a drop in the bucket. But it wasn't. And what happened was when we pulled these data together, we discovered to our astonishment that this very large decline in mortality rates in midlife that had gone on for the best part of 100 years had stopped. And depending a bit on which years you used, was now actually rising. And this had started, it turns out, in the mid-90s. And then when we saw the suicide, well, we felt, there must be other things in there. It can't just be suicide. And right enough, it wasn't just suicide. A lot of it was opioid overdoses. And also a lot of it was deaths from alcoholic liver disease. So I think in an interview with the press a few months after we published the paper, Anne invented the term deaths of despair to cover those three categories. That's alcoholism, drug overdoses, and suicide. And she likes to say, well, you're killing yourself either quickly or sort of quickly or much more slowly, which is the case with alcoholism, for instance. So this is not like COVID. It's not like a virus that comes from outside. This is something internal to people that's causing them, more or less quickly to do away with themselves. And this trend picked up in the mid-90s, around the time that OxyContin was approved, really took off after that. At the time we first noticed it in 2013, African-American, Black, non-Hispanics, and Hispanics seemed to be largely exempt from this. But unfortunately, after about 2013, that stopped being true, too. So it's now basically affecting all racial groups, but it's largely confined to people without a four-year degree. So that's where the working class comes in.
And that's the traditional definition that's used is of the working class as those without college degrees. And again, it's something we're very familiar with in our region here. What your book discusses some of the social and economic forces that led to this, and everybody's got their theories behind this, but what did you find that were some of the key things that seemed to cause this?
Well, you know, once we got onto this four-year BA versus non-BA distinction, we started parsing all sorts of other social pathologies along that divide. A very important thing to remember, and not everybody will know this, is that about two-thirds of the adult population does not have a four-year BA. So the people with the BA, the intellectuals, the cosmopolitan intellectuals, if you like, are only a third of the population. And what we discovered was just a whole tangle of things going on at the same time. Wages, median wages for men without a BA have been falling since about 1970. So, you know, the labor market, which we see as very close to the root of this thing, has just turned against people without a four-year college degree. And then, you know, their marriages are coming apart. They don't go to church anymore. The childbearing has not gone down, but not to the childbearing out of marriage. And so, you know, you get these men, and well, men in particular, I'm a man, so it appeals immediately to me, is, you know, if you're in your 50s and 60s, when you should be, you know, thinking about grandchildren and approaching old age with the support of a family that supported you throughout your life, a lot of these men are finding out that, you know, they may have had kids, but they don't know those kids anymore because the unions they were in were fragile. They didn't last for very long. And so, you know, there's just a tremendous amount of stuff. And I haven't even begun to talk about, you know, what we started with, which was pain. So just about every form of pain you can think of is accelerating, rising among people in middle age without a BA and not for people who have a BA. So BA is sort of like a magic talisman that seems to exempt you from all these terrible pathologies.
In our region, we've had a lot of examples of big manufacturing facilities shut down and move overseas. And then you start seeing evidence of these deaths of despair increase, life expectancy dropping. And, you're familiar with that, I'm sure, where you're at, where in some of these smaller communities, these were good jobs, good wages, health benefits, they're gone. People 40 and 50 years old, what do they do? Did you see a link up between any of that and the deaths of despair?
Well, partially, yes. And it's clear that destruction, what we're seeing here is a massive loss of jobs for people without a BA. And a lot of what you're talking about, these plants closing or the firm doesn't close, but it goes to Mexico or it goes to China or somewhere. And people are being replaced by robots or the things that they used to make are now made abroad and imported here. So we think all of that is terribly important. But, you know, the thing that causes us not to overemphasize that is that, you know, that's happening in Britain, too. It's happening in Germany and France. It's happening all over the rich Western world. Maybe not in Germany, which has very successfully managed to export a tremendous number of cars to China. But by and large, these forces of automation and of competition from once poor countries, those are universal. And yet, a big increase in deaths of despair you only really see in America. You see some of it in Canada, see some of it in the UK, but really not so much on continental Europe. So there's got to be something here that's specific to America, which is actually making these jobs go away much more rapidly here. And one of the things that we think here, and we think is incredibly important, is the incredibly high cost of healthcare and the fact that so much healthcare in the U.S. is funded through employer-based healthcare. And that is a lot of money. I mean, family policy. The typical family policy today costs about $20,000 a year, okay? So, and a single person policy, cheaper, is about $11,000 a year. So someone has to pay that, and it's either, of course, the workers think the employer is paying for it, but if the employer is paying for it, the employer has to get that back somewhere else. And where it comes back out of is people's wages, or in the ultimate case, out of jobs. You know, if you think of, you know, someone who's a CEO or even a middle-level manager who's earning $150,000 or $200,000 a year, you know, a $10, $10,000 or $20,000 premium is not a big deal. It's a fraction of the wage. But if you're talking about someone in food services or a driver, or even someone on an assembly line who's earning, you know, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 a year, an extra $10,000 can make the difference between that job being there and that job not being there. So you see a lot of people shedding health insurance, a lot of people buying worse health insurance with very high deductibles and stuff like that, and a lot of people just losing jobs altogether. So that's one thing that's unique here. We're the only country in the rich world that funds our healthcare in that way.
And that employer-based system that you mentioned is just politically sacrosanct for a lot of folks. There was talk when the United States tried to tackle healthcare with Obamacare of doing away with that. And boy, that's like the third rail. But I want to emphasize to our listeners, you are a capitalist. You're not a socialist. Want to overthrow the system or anything? So you're coming at this from a more, I think pragmatic standpoint of wanting to preserve this. But what do you think we need to do to reform the healthcare system?
Well, we need to fix this. Is one of the things. I mean, it's not just healthcare. I mean, healthcare is we have. You know, the worst life expectancy in the rich world, even before COVID came along. And COVID certainly hasn't made it any better. So there's an enormous amount of money, that, you know, $1.05 from the U.S. economy is going to healthcare. And, you know, there's no other country spends anything like that. Mm-hmm. So if you reduced our healthcare down to the second highest in the world, which is Switzerland, we would save about $1 trillion a year, which is enough to fund the whole military and have 50% left over. So, you know, you're talking about really big money here. And this huge bloated system is like a huge parasite on the economy. But as you say, you know, we really believe in fixing capitalism, not getting rid of it. I mean, capitalism has been a huge tool for benefiting everybody around the world. The trouble is, it's not very well shared in the U.S. over the last 50 years, and a lot of it is going through special favors, through special deals, through special tax breaks to just very, very wealthy people, whether they're bankers or hospital administrators, you know, people who used to be doctors and now paying themselves $15 million a year to run hospitals that are gobbling up other hospitals and raising the prices. So, you know, there's a tremendous amount of abuse of capitalism, and we're not seeing the competition that capitalism is so good at and yields so many benefits.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Angus Deaton, who's the co-author, along with Ann Case, of a book called Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. It came out a couple of years ago, still very relevant across the nation, and especially in our Heartland region. Angus has been discussing the book a little bit, what led him to undertake this, and we've been talking a little bit about some of the forces at play, especially the healthcare system. A couple points here I thought were interesting throughout the book. You know, every month unemployment statistics come out, and everybody trumpets them. If they're going down, it's a sign of our economic health. If they're going up, things are off going off the wrong track. And you kind of question that is a really reliable indicator for economic health.
Well, you know, measuring unemployment is a really complicated thing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you have to say, you know, would you take a job if one were offered? And, you know, that's sort of a matter of opinion. So it's not like there's a line of people waiting outside the factory saying, I want to get back to work. You know, it's much more judgment call. And what we tend to look at for these long terms is what in the lingo of economists is called the EPOD ratio, which means the employment to population ratio, which is the total number of people who are employed divided by the population. And that's the thing that's been going down for a very, very long time, something like 50 years for men. For women, it used to rise because there was a lot of women's labor force that didn't used to be there before. But since about 2000, then that ratio has been falling for women, too. That ratio of employment to population is still lower today than it was before the pandemic. So even though people are saying, well, the labor market is very tight, you know, the lowest unemployment we've ever seen, as any amount of jobs, then there's still a lot of people who were in employment before the pandemic who are not in employment now. Some of that is no doubt like me, they're at home scared, they don't want to go out yet. But some of it is just the jobs may not be there. So I don't want to parse that to say exactly what that is, but nevertheless, that downward trend, you know, it does better in when the economy is booming, but when it goes down again, it always goes down to below where it was before. And that's the prime evidence over the last 50 years that, you know, people without a VA, this happens to people without a VA, the EPOP ratio is falling, are actually out of the labor force because the jobs are not there, not because, as some argue, that they're sort of lazy and they've decided they'd rather stay home and play video games.
There was a really interesting statement that you made in the book about the role of religion, and you alluded to religion a little earlier. More religious people do better, but more religious places do worse. Can you amplify on that for me?
Well, it's presumably about something else. If you look at individuals, it's certainly clear that on almost all social outcomes, and even, you know, the extent to which people think their lives are going well, people who regularly attend church or for whom religion is very important in their lives do better. But I think sometimes religion is very strong in places that are bad for other reasons. So, you know, here's the story that may resonate with some of your listeners. You know, I grew up in Britain. My dad grew up in a mining town in Yorkshire, a really horrible place. That was a town where there was a lot of violence, a lot of drinking, a lot of abuse of women. My father always felt very uncomfortable there as a youth. And he turned to religion, and he became a Methodist. And that, in some sense, saved his life. And Methodism is very strong in those working-class towns in Britain. So you get these places that are quite religious, but they're quite religious in reaction to bad stuff that's going on around them. So when you get that correlation between religiosity and bad outcomes, it's often because people are using religion to somehow soothe themselves or make up for the bad places they're living. In poor countries around the world, the religiosity is very, very strong, and that, I think, would be the reason it saves people, you know, or it offers them a sort of salvation that they're not finding from the secular place in which they're living.
Do you feel that, and I have to bring politics up to this because it's, you know, again, my show's focused on these issues since its inception, but does this provide a little bit of a window into why some of the working class, those without college degrees, turned to a candidate like Donald Trump, so different in 2016, that maybe...
Absolutely.
Maybe it was a result of some of these forces going on, and they felt like nobody else was really talking to them.
No, I think, you know, one of the things that we learned in doing this work, and I hope people will take away from the book, is, you know, a sympathy for people who turned away from the Democrats that is not widely shared in a community like Princeton, New Jersey, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if instead of saying, why did they vote for Trump? I mean, you could say, why couldn't they vote for Hillary Clinton? And it's sort of like the Democrats, who used to be the party of the working classes. You know, they were supported by unions. They were a pro-union party. They were a pro-working class party. There aren't any unions anymore. And the Democrats have become basically a coalition between the wealthier educated people on the one hand and minorities on the other. Now, you know the Heartland much better than I do, but for many people in the Heartland, they see those two groups, sort of minorities and educated intellectuals, as being their natural enemies. One, because they have no sympathy for them at all, and they see them as despising them. And the other, because they're worried that, you know, racial preference or whatever, the jobs that they used to have, are being taken by minorities. That may or may not be true. But it's clear that it's a very strong perception, minorities and immigrants. So, you know, the Democrats have sort of lost any claim to represent this working class, these people without a VA. And so, you know, I don't want to analyze everything that Donald Trump put to them, and much of it I dislike intensely. But you can sort of see why that alternative would appeal to people who feel they've just been incredibly badly treated for a really, really long time.
You mentioned in the book about reforming the healthcare system was kind of the centerpiece of what you and Ann advocate. What are a couple other things you see that you think that measures that could be taken to perhaps address some of these deaths of despair?
Well, as you said, reforming the healthcare system is sort of like the third rail. So I have other things to propose that are even more difficult than that. I think, well, one that's not that difficult, actually, would be to get rich people to pay some taxes. And I think one of the things we've learned over the last 10 or 15 years is that very, very wealthy people pay ridiculously low taxes. I don't know if you know about this scheme, which is called buy, borrow, and die, whereby rich entrepreneurs can avoid ever paying any taxes. And you buy a business, you make a huge success of it, you pay yourself essentially nothing, you borrow money, and you, if you're a billionaire, you can borrow money at like less than 1% interest, you live off that, and then when you die, the share price is stepped up by death, so your heirs don't pay any tax either. So we've got ourselves a system in which people who are essentially living off wealth one way or another are really not being taxed at all. So there's a lot that could be done to fix that. I know it's very hard because wealthy people have enormous clout in Washington. But, for instance, here's something that I think would work and really would help is a value-added tax. European countries have about a 17.5% value added tax. So, you know, it wouldn't get directly at wealth, but would it ensure these people who are spending huge sums of money without earning anything, paying no income tax, would actually pay some tax on what they spend. So I think that would really help. The really hard things are getting money out of politics. And, you know, we used to have a much more balanced politics in Washington because unions were powerful. They're really not powerful anymore. And the big lobbyists in Washington are, you know, the big tech firms, the hospitals, the pharma companies. And they're making out like bandits. And that making out is all at the expense of the rest of us. In particular, actually, the rest of us, I shouldn't include myself, I did fine. But it's at the expense of, you know, if you like, the heartland of America.
We have a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask you, the book was written in 2020, which is not that long ago, but boy, it seems like it because we've been through a lot since then.
Yeah.
Have you tracked some of the measures since the onset of COVID? But also, I'm anxious to get your thoughts on the labor market, which you said the labor market is a key thing that you looked at here, but it's kind of tightened up and wages are going up and inflation's going up. But in terms of what's happened with COVID and the labor market since 2020, are there any trends here that you follow that may be improving or staying about the same or worse?
On the labor market, it's perhaps a little too early to tell.
Okay.
It's clear that a lot of people are not accepting the sort of working conditions they accepted before, which is a wonderful thing. On the other hand, a lot of them have money which came from their payments during 2020 and 21. And so they have money in the bank, and eventually that will run out. And so maybe we'll get back to this again. So I'm not super sanguine about that. And as I said, the unemployment rate is very low, but the employment to population ratio is still not back to where it was before the pandemic. On the deaths of despair, the suicides actually went down during the pandemic. And apparently that's happened in a very large number of countries around the world. And, you know, suicides go down in wartime, so it may be a little bit like that as sort of an external enemy. Alcohol deaths and drug deaths have soared during the pandemic, and we don't know whether that was because of the pandemic or because of would have happened anyway. In particular, the opioid overdose deaths were rising very rapidly even before the pandemic. So Ann and I tend to think a lot of that is just a continuation of something we've seen before rather than something that was driven by the pandemic, but it's certainly possible it was driven by the pandemic. The alcohol deaths were somewhat of a surprise to us in 2020, but it's possible that people are binge drinking during the pandemic. I think most of us who'd be locked up for any period of time would understand that, understand how that could happen. But again, it's preliminary days yet.
Well, it's a very important book, and I urge my listeners to take a look at it, get a copy, because it's so relevant to our region and what's been going on. Again, it's called Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. I've been delighted to have as my guest today one of the co-authors, Angus Deaton. His co-author is Ann Case. This book is recent enough, again, to have important implications for our area. And unlike a lot of books, they outline the problem, but they also give some possible solutions, which are going to be difficult, but nothing's done easily, it seems like, these days, especially in the area of public policy. But Angus, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be our guest today and maybe have you back at some point.
Thank you very much, Robin. I've enjoyed it, and I'm so glad you read the book.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
You got this, girl.
Love Girls, the podcast, is all about storytelling and empowerment.
Our mission is to share a space for women and girls to talk about the stuff that matters to them most. Love speaks to the support we give each other as we search for our own path to success.
L, we can lead the way.
O,
overcome barriers.
V,
value each other.
E,
and empower each other. That's love.
Because every girl has a story.
And our stories matter.